Hi, I'm Cliff Reynolds with Willamette Christian Church. I'm one of the pastors here, and I'm with Joy and Joel to follow up on the message that they gave last Sunday. It was a great message with a lot of questions afterwards that came out of their message, and so we want to address several that were submitted by you, and I'm going to ask Joy and Joel to comment on those. I'll probably just read the question and then let them dive in and answer that. Our first question is was written in and says, do you have any good rules for communicating effectively when life gets busy or stressful or when one or the other offends each other?
You know, that's a good question. I think just a couple just broad principles we'll share first, and then Joy, go ahead and interrupt whenever. But number one is that I think, you know, communication really reveals what's important to a person. And, you know, Jesus says that, you know, out of the overflow of the mouth or the heart, the mouth speaks. And so whatever comes out of our mouths actually reveals what's in our heart. And so if there's a lack of communication in a marriage relationship, I'd be concerned that they're not sharing their heart with each other or who they are. So it's not, there's not a safe environment for that to happen. So, but it's a good question. It sounds like they're looking for more specific helps, you know, good ideas for communicating effectively. Joy, do you want to speak into that a little bit?
Sure. And, you know, there's tons of books out there, and there's the right way and the wrong way that the professionals say. We can just speak to what happens for our relationship. So, one of the first things that we have learned is that there's a time and a place and a way for everything. I've learned over the years that I cannot handle emotional and deep conversations past 9 o'clock. I won't think clearly. And so even though the scriptures say, do not let the sun go down on your wrath, sometimes I do need a good night's sleep and everything looks different in the morning, and then we can have have a better conversation then.
That's so true.
Yeah.
So there's a time and a place for communication.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Depending on what the issue is.
That's right. And it needs to be outside of the emotion of it all. Mm-hmm. So if you can table whatever issue it is and then maybe go on a date over coffee and talk about it, if you can do it in a time where the kids aren't running around or there's not these extra pressures and stress, if you can do it when not everybody's tired, the conversation will go a lot more smoothly. So, and along that lines, we've learned each other's bent. Joel knows that about me, that I get really tired. And can't think clearly past a certain time. And so he respects that. And I know that he has a hard time having a conversation right when he comes home from work and the kids want his attention and he has other things on his mind. So
yeah, Joy can't think clearly past 9. I can't think clearly past about 3 or 4 p.m. So there's about a 5-hour window, 6-hour window.
Mornings are good, right?
Mornings are good. There's about a 3-hour window that's good for me. But no, that's good. The idea there, Joy, I think what you're sharing is that we have different personalities. Mm-hmm. Some people just, they're gabbers. They like to talk. They whatever. And then that's going to be expressed differently based on their personality. And so allowing people to be who they are, you know, not expecting them to necessarily speak exactly the way you might speak. It's okay.
Right. And not putting a value statement or a judgment on the fact that they're quieter or that they're talkative or however their personality is, but learning to work within that and work together on that. For me personally, I'm a ranter. I have to get it all out right away. Mm-hmm. And then I'll be really quiet.
And I like to listen.
It's perfect.
It's perfect. And I like to listen and just kind of process. Yeah. You know, I'm very much a processor. So I'll just kind of, you know, let it stew within me a little bit. Maybe stew is not the right word, but, you know, kind of simmer there. And then I'll have something to say when I feel like it's appropriate. But so she doesn't need to, we've learned, Joy doesn't say, hey, you need to talk more quickly or tell me, you know, she doesn't press me on that. She allows that to sit within me. And I think it works for us. The other thing is just not, you know, making assumptions about what the other person is saying or what they're thinking, you know. For instance, just like, you know, he knows that I'm angry, you know, or he should know that I'm angry by the tone of my voice or the look in my eye or whatever. And the truth is he may not know that you're angry, or he might not know how angry or how upset you are. And so not assuming that the other can read your mind.
That's right. conversation needs to be pretty kind but direct, because we can't read each other's minds. Can we share our little thing yesterday?
Maybe. Go ahead.
We can always edit.
That's true. We can always edit. That's right. We do have Cliff here to moderate us if if it gets out of hand. No.
Yes.
Yesterday, Joel decided not to take his typical Wednesdays off because he wants to take Friday off. And so, but we didn't communicate well about that. And
by we, she means me.
Well, he told me, but he didn't ask me. So I had all these other plans, and I thought we were going to go out to lunch. And there was just some assuming on both ends that that it would be okay. And
I'm definitely, you know, I think that's kind of human nature a little bit, is we just kind of assume the other person knows what we're thinking.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the longer you're married with somebody, the more you learn to communicate clearly. At least that's the effort should be made toward that end. And as it is, then the relationship strengthened. So,
and along those lines, keeping short accounts is really helpful. Instead of stewing for a long period of time or assuming that the other person can read your mind or knows what you're thinking or feeling, just be direct and say, you know what, that really hurt my feelings, even in the moment. Calmly saying that hurt my feelings, or I misunderstood you there, or I'm sorry, even in the moment, keeps it from just building and becoming this big emotional thing.
Yeah. I think some people, and I say this a lot, but some people will say, well, I just need to get this off my chest. You know, I just have to speak my mind, kind of thing. And the truth is, actually, no, you don't. And it's probably good that everybody in society doesn't share whatever they're thinking or in the way that they want to. So there's going to, it's going to require some self-control, which is, you know, evidence of the Holy Spirit living within a person. And so, and that's okay. Even if you're really upset or this is an emotional argument, it's controlling by the Spirit's power, those emotions, learning to speak respectful to each other and listening well. And, you know, I know that's tough sometimes, but really we need to think of that being the goal, you know, and the desire, instead of just saying, well, that's just how I am. I'm really emotional. That's not good enough. So there's things even, you know, as we wrap up this question, like kind of rules that we have about speaking to each other. For instance, you know, we, I don't know, there's words that we won't use, you know, I don't know, name calling,
no
just
swearing.
Being petty. Yeah, no swearing, obviously. you know, I guess maybe we'd be surprised, but you know, we don't slander the other person, and that's a little bit, that's living out of understanding that, you know what, I've made plenty of mistakes. I'm forgiven. I need to extend grace because I've been given grace, even though in this instance, maybe in a particular instance, I'm all right and she's all wrong, or vice versa. But we understand that during the relationship, we've both offended each other. And so it's extending grace as God gives it to us. And do you want to make a comment about the D word?
The D word. We made a promise to each other way early in the marriage that we would never even bring up the word divorce. That wouldn't even be an option, not in anger. That's just not an option for us. And so we don't use that word in our home when it comes to our conflicts.
Yeah. Maybe even before we got married. But yeah, that was just never an option. So that forces us to work on it.
Great. Good. You mentioned going out on dates or going for coffee. A lot of couples just time just to talk. And you mentioned coming home and the kids want your attention. Do you have a set time every week, every month, that you make sure it's just you two and you guys are talking about the issues of the day, obviously in the good time when somebody hasn't fallen asleep or can listen?
Yeah, we actually have a couple times. One is kind of our date lunch. Usually that's on Wednesdays, and sometimes it's coffee, it's earlier or whatever, but usually it's lunch, and we've been pretty consistent about that. That's been good. The other thing we've just kind of added is we have a time for just calendaring each week. So this really helps us communicate well. Instead of living on the edge throughout the week, we pretty much know what our week's going to look like, you know, a week in advance. There's obviously some, you know, alterations or whatever that can happen. But so we just kind of go over the schedule, go over the kids' schedules, go over each other's schedules, and that helps set the expectations for the week.
And I know that we're in an unusual situation in that Joel's day off is on Wednesday, so our children are in school, and not everybody has that same kind of luxury. But when our children were young, we would use the evenings for some of those dates, and we didn't have a lot of money, and we couldn't always get a babysitter, but we could put the kids to bed at 7:30 and lay out a blanket on the floor and eat Chinese food and talk. So
When the kids are really little, you can actually change the clocks in your house.
That's right.
And put them to bed at like 6:30.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Or just put them in the car for a car ride and off you go, you know, on a car ride to be able to talk.
That's a good idea too. Yeah.
Great. That first question actually was a two-parter. And the second part of the question is it true that men sometimes need space when they get home from a long day? And is it okay? What about if the wife works full-time also?
Well, just a comment here about men and women are different. I mean, that's stating the obvious, obviously, but and just a general statement. I know this isn't true for every relationship, but general statement is to say that women like to speak or talk, use more words. And studies have even shown that they use like a 33% or 50% more words in a given day than men do. And so, you know, regardless, even if both are working, there's still going to be a tendency naturally the way they're wired for women to want to talk more. So,
and also if we're talking about physiology, there's a little part of the brain, it's called the corpus callosum, that's in between the right and left hemispheres. And women, it's the neurons that go back and forth between those two parts of the brain. One's a logical side of the brain, one's the emotional side of the brain. And that corpus callosum is actually larger in women than it is men, which means that women can go more quickly back and forth between the emotions and the logic. Whereas men, and I'm so glad God created them this way for work and for war and protecting, and they can really focus either on one side of the brain or the other side of the brain. Mm-hmm. So at the end of a long day, he's been focusing in one side of the brain, which has probably been the more logical, get things done side, and then to come home and to have to transfer to the other side of emotion and being able to talk, it takes a little more effort. Mm-hmm. And women are just naturally good at multitasking those things.
Yeah, women tend to multitask better, men tend to focus better, and I think that's a good point.
Yeah, and it's studies have been shown that men can take up to 7 hours longer than women to process complex emotional data. So what that means for women is if you have some big conversation you want to get into, maybe you let him know at the beginning of the day, hey, I want to talk about this maybe when you get home, or can we set a time, and then just give him time to ease into that idea and to think about that.
Yeah, but giving a time to discuss would be important for him. So it's not just saying, oh, he needs rest. It's saying, hey, can we talk about this in a couple hours or a few hours or when the kids go down or whatever? Then he has that expectation. And he can even be thinking a little bit about it ahead of time. Every relationship is different, though.
In general, it's pretty unreasonable to expect a man to come home from a hard day at work and then just dive into some really difficult conversation.
Yeah.
He definitely needs that space. And if a woman works, maybe she needs that space too. Every woman's different, but it's much more likely that the man would need that time.
If it's really a difficult issue, she should just call him at work. I mean, if it's something major, you know, then that can't wait. Then obviously just call then, not even have to wait till he gets home. So,
but good. Thank you.
Really
kind of what I'm hearing is that whatever they need to talk about together, it needs to be intentional. It just can't be flippant or all of a sudden let's talk about this. So depending on their work situation, their personalities, their temperament, everything, they have to really be intent about when they get together that they give it their best.
Yeah.
So
I think that's a good point. I mean, it doesn't just naturally happen. There's too many distractions. There's too many things that change in the course of a day. You can't just live spontaneously all the time. That's something I've had to learn, but
Second question deals with spiritual leadership of the husband, and this is one that is not just in our church, but is nationwide, almost worldwide, and seems to be an ongoing issue in the church. And so I'm going to read the question, and because it deals with that. It says, I have a husband who isn't a strong leader or a spiritual leader. I am the stronger one, but realize he needs to lead but won't. How do I help him grow? He is content for me to lead in that way. How do you respond to that?
Well, the first thing that I would say, and I've just been thinking about this lately, I hear women say this a lot, and I know that it's true that men need to grow in this area. But I think we as women need to be careful putting the label on our husbands and saying that they're not the spiritual leader. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes our definition...
It can be kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy too.
Yeah, a self-fulfilling prophecy, but also what we think is a spiritual leader might be different than what he thinks is a spiritual leader.
Right.
And I don't know that the women are the ones that get to or need to define that. Mm-hmm. So he might not be leading family devotions with mm-hmm. your kids every night, but he's out there serving in his community or coaching and leading with integrity and being mm-hmm. a light in that way and an example for your family. So certainly family devotions are great, and if he does that, and maybe he'll grow to that point, but I think we need to be careful to not take the lead in saying what is spiritual leadership. Does
yeah.
that make sense?
So it's kind of defining what spiritual leadership is yeah. important. So, you know, a lot of times maybe she, and I don't know the circumstance here, but maybe this wife is not, maybe she's a stay-at-home mom or whatever, and she has capacity to go to a couple different Bible studies and to read and to meditate and all this, and he's working at, you know, PGE or wherever, he's doing his job, and so he doesn't necessarily, his life doesn't allow him to consume all the spiritual truth that maybe she has, but it's important to that we don't, you know, define spiritual depth or leadership solely by Bible knowledge or whatever, even though that's obviously super important. But, you know, ultimately it's loving God and loving others. That's what Jesus says, right? So if he's doing that well, she can know all the Bible answers in the world, but if she's not doing that well, then actually he's more spiritually mature in that instance. But let's just assume that, I don't know, let's just assume that they're both whatever, equally knowledgeable or whatever. He's just not stepping into his position of leadership. I think what she can do is encourage, and we talked about this, you know, on Sunday a little bit, but encourage, meaning give him courage to step in there. And so when he takes initiative and whatever, he leads the family in a prayer or he says, hey, you guys, let's go to church or whatever, you know, the wife can encourage him in that and say, honey, I thank you so much for your spiritual leadership there. And I think it's really awesome, you know, and he's going to receive that. That's going to be something he's going to feel respected and something that he can grow into a little bit. So encouragement, I think, is one of the key things that a wife can do.
Yeah. And I think the other thing is to give him space to lead. This is just a silly illustration, but I remember when I need Joel to do something around the house, not so spiritual, like take out the trash. I'll say, honey, can you take out the trash? And if it's not done in my way and on my timeline, I'll just say, oh, fine, I'll do it myself. And that doesn't give him the opportunity to take on that role. And so too it is with spiritual leadership.
You know, so it's like enabling. If she takes out the trash, then yeah, she's not allowing me to do my responsibility.
That's right.
And let the trash overflow until he figures it out.
Right.
And Joy, right. Early on, you did that.
I used to set it out in the middle of the kitchen so we tripped over it.
but now, you know, it doesn't get to that point. But yeah.
It's true with spiritual leadership too. If you're like, honey, can you please do devotions with the kids tonight? And he's like, sure. If he's not doing it in your way, or if he's not doing it as quickly as you want or as often as you want, and so you just step in there to fill in that gap, you're not leaving him room to grow into that leadership role or to lead in the way that God has designed him to lead. So sometimes we have to do those things in our own way. So if you want your kids to learn how to pray and your husband's not doing it quite yet, then As you're tucking them into bed, just model that for the kids. But you don't need to take the reins full on from him if it's not how you want it
mm-hmm.
to be.
Mm-hmm. And even looking at that dance illustration that you shared on Sunday, Joy, just so good, is that, you know, she might be the better dancer. She might be the expert. She might be the pro. Maybe he's a novice or two left feet or whatever. But she can still, even then, allow him to lead and make the dance beautiful by giving him that room to lead and giving them that space and yielding, you know, or deferring to his leadership.
Absolutely. And in all of these questions, and I think it needs to be said here, prayer is a huge, huge component of this. The Bible says that the prayer of a righteous person, a man or a woman, accomplishes a lot.
Yeah.
And so what maybe you feel like you can't accomplish in the physical realm, God can accomplish in the spiritual realm as we take it to the Lord. So I would just really encourage spending that concentrated time in prayer for your husband in his leadership role.
Yeah.
Yeah, great answers. I would just affirm both of your sayings. Joy, you mentioned on Sunday that men respond to approval and admiration. And so anytime we can see a man doing something right and give him praise for that, and he's going
to
respond.
You know, yeah.
And that's where prayer comes in, too, to tie that in, is the Holy Spirit's going to remind you, oh, look at that. Yeah, I need to thank you for praying with the kids, or thank you for doing that. And that we men, we take that and we'll just run with it. It's real hard. You know, 10 negative things wipe out, a positive.
Right,
so
right.
The more positive, the more we're going to respond and stuff.
That's
so that's
good.
Great.
And I would add one more thing. In Scripture, 1 Peter 3, it says that the quiet and submissive spirit, not that she has to be totally silent, but her spirit is at peace. And she's submissive to her husband. It says that her unbelieving husband can be won over spiritually. And I think this is true across the whole spectrum of where our men are spiritually. So even if he's a believer, but he's lacking in certain areas of faith or certain areas of spiritual leadership, your submissive spirit towards him and your responsiveness towards him and your encouragement of him will win him over and help him to grow spiritually. That's a biblical promise and truth that we see in 1 Peter 3. So.
Yeah, but isn't it true we tend to do the same thing that's not working over and over and over again? And, you know, in this case, maybe she keeps grasping at that leadership and keeps kind of forcing her, you know, opinions and attitudes and whatever on him. And I wish you would do this. And why don't you ever? And whatever. And it never changes him. You know, really what Joy's saying is true. So there needs to be a whole different kind of equation there. And because that actually does work both what Joy and Cliff were just sharing. So
the next question ties right into the one we just discussed, and that's when a woman would take the spiritual leadership and assign it to somebody else, either make somebody else a role model or actually give another man that permission to be the spiritual leader in her life. The actual question is, how do you relate to a wife who puts her father as the first man in her life? Her first love, respect relationship is with her father, and she brings that into the marriage, good and bad. How would you respond to someone like that?
Well, number one, you know, again, the overarching principle is to take responsibility for what God has called you to. So we don't know, you know, where he or she is coming from. I mean, is he really controlling and not being, responsible to love his wife well? Is she being codependent? Is she being, you know, is she abdicating her responsibility to yield to her husband? Or is there a little bit of both or a lot of both or whatever?
Yeah, it's hard not being able to have a dialogue with whoever's asking this question. Because it could be that the man is just being ridiculous and over the top and, you know,
super controlling
in the situation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then she keeps going to her dad.
Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. And that's why I'd like to kind of use this to bounce on to, what do they do for the men who feel like they're competing against Joel. Every Sunday morning they see him, and that's who their wife sees. And so all week they hear, why aren't you more like Joel? Why aren't you? And they're telling their wife, well, didn't you hear Joy? You don't know what it's like being married to the pastor.
Yeah, there's plenty of men I want to be more like too.
Well, and let me just speak to that. Joel is my husband. You have your husband, right? Yeah. And so your job is to help your husband be the best that he can be before the Lord. And it doesn't help for you to look at Joel and compare. Comparison is a sin. And we need to be content and happy with the people that God has placed in our own lives. And so that would be my first word of caution there to the women who are out there. And I feel for the men whose wives compare them to other men, whether it be Joel or their dads. I think that happens a lot.
That is of no use. That's not profitable at all.
No.
In fact, just the opposite. It's harmful. So, and that could be kind of what's happening here. She's comparing her husband to her dad. Her dad, you know, is her hero or whatever, and she keeps going to him for advice and help. And really, you know, the way I think of that whole leave cleave principle, when a man and a woman are joined together and united and married, they're not an extension of the family tree. They actually become their own tree at that point. Now, maybe they're still in the same orchard as their family, you know, but they're their own tree. It's time to leave mom and dad and cleave to who? One another and the Lord. And so that's really what marriage is. And so there's a point to be made there that, you know, maybe she needs to do that, or maybe he needs to do that, or whatever, that they cleave to one another. And that even speaks to the whole comparison thing. And who cares about anybody else? You know, I mean, not that we don't care about others, but, you know, that's not applicable to what God has called me to and the responsibilities he's given me. So,
and I think to speak to the women here on this, you are no longer, what Joel is saying, you're no longer under the authority of your father. You have a new authority under your husband. Mm-hmm. And so it's not appropriate to go back to mom and dad and to talk about all the things that you don't enjoy about your husband or all the problems that you're having.
No.
They don't need that burden. They've already parented you.
Never do that. Like, I would say never do that.
Yeah.
I mean, find a counselor, you know, a trusted Christian godly friend or whatever, somebody, you know, a community group leader or whatever, but you never go to mom and dad to address, because whose side are they going to take?
Right.
Yeah. The child that they, you know, raised, or whatever the man or the woman that they married. So they're always going to choose their child.
And even if the relationship gets better, they're still going to always think lesser of the husband in that situation.
And that's not good for you.
No.
Right? You want them to think highly. Just the opposite. Share with your parents, you know, how great your husband or how great your wife is, and find those things that they're really good at. So, you know, I would just say that for the man, if her father is a Christian, I think it'd be appropriate. I mean, you got to understand the nature of that relationship that you have with him, but just to talk to him and say, hey, look, you know, my wife, your daughter, as you know, totally respects you and loves to go to you for advice and counsel. And some of that's great, but, she's just having a hard time maybe transitioning her dependence on you to, you know, a place where I can have that role, you know, in her life. And so can you help me with that? Now, if he's a Christian dad and is a godly dad, he'll understand that. And he'll say, you know what, you're right. And it's not that to say that he can never go to him for advice, but the husband needs to play the role of being that, you know, kind of leader in the marriage and family.
And I think it goes back to that biblical role again. I think as the husband continues to love her and to lead her and to protect her, hopefully that done consistently over time, she'll begin to see that she doesn't need her dad, that she has all the love that she needs from her husband, and those ties will begin to lessen a little bit over time.
I would even say for like neutral things, I'm going to call my dad to build the kids a tree fort because he's really good at construction or whatever. That's fine. I'm not saying don't do that, but I think it can get to a point where the husband, you know, maybe he's not skilled with craftsmanship and carpentry or whatever, and he just kind of feels a little bit less than. if he's feeling devalued, that's not worth the greatest tree fort in the world, you know? So kind of just being, you know, hopefully she is sensitive to that. And again, it's elevating, and we talked about this all throughout the series, it's valuing the marriage, elevating the marriage. That comes first, you know? It's a relationship with the Lord certainly is central, but apart from that, it's our marriage number one. And really protecting that and, yeah, building into that.
Cliff, do you have a unique perspective on this, being a father-in-law? And
yeah, and it's a tough transition to go from parenting to someone else is taking care of your most prized possession. So I've tried to make for me, in my mindset, a switch from a parent to a mentor. Mm. And that's just a total different role. A parent, you're expecting results from what you say. As a mentor, you're suggesting paths and avenues to take, a different way to look at a situation, but you're not expecting that person to do and obey what you say.
Yeah.
You're just to walk along beside them. And Joel's so illustration is perfect. If it's building a tree fort, then you bring alongside that son or daughter-in-law that isn't real handy, and you take a month to build that with their help at their speed rather than you kick it out in a day because it's going to be theirs, their tree. And so you're just mentoring. You're showing them, here's how you put it together so they can put the next one together on their own.
I love that.
It's a mental. Mental, and it's real hard to make, you know, that switch. But that's what I attempt to do.
That's
not well all the time, but.
No, that's so good. And just a point to be said about, you know, and I share this sometimes, but that you're only a parent for a season, your mom and dad for as long as you're alive, right? But you're only a parent for a season. And once Junior, you know, is out of the house. So I would say, by the way, if your kids are living with you and they're 34, you're still parenting them. But when they're out of the house and being responsible for their own lives, you do transition out of that role as parent. You're no longer parenting them. And they don't have to obey you. They still need to honor you, but they don't have to obey. And then you move into that mentor role. That's so great. Yeah. Really good point.
Yeah. Thanks. Let's switch gears a little. And a lot of the things we've been talking about have been for a Christian wife and a Christian husband. Let's look at when one of the spouses is not a Christian. The question that we have is, what if you are living together and you're like you're married with kids, but you're not married, and the wife found God shortly after you had a child, and he has not. She wants to marry, but he would rather not, just continue to live as they are. The wife is writing this, obviously, and she says, I struggle with this every day. Is it better to leave or to stay? So in this given situation, plus in living with a non-Christian, what are some guidelines and suggestions you have?
Yeah, it's a tough one. I mean, it really is. And we just want to make we have some convictions, obviously, about this, but as you hear our answer, I hope you don't take it as flippant. And because this is a really hard one. You got kids involved, you know, you got just a lot of complex pieces of this puzzle. But so, you know, the first thing is maybe just to say, hey, have you and your boyfriend really discussed this at length? Again, not making that assumption we talked about earlier in communication. Mm-hmm. Have you really been clear about your desire to be married and why, you know, as a Christian with him? And had a, you know, longer than a 15-minute conversation, taken some time to really hash this over. Once that's done, however, I mean, my own conviction, what I believe Scripture would teach is, you don't live with somebody of the opposite sex unless you're married. So, you know, ideally he would be man up and take responsibility, and he would move out.
Or marry her right away,
which would be great. Go down to the courthouse, sign the paper, have a ceremony later or whatever. But that would be the responsible thing to do, you know, that he moves out. If he's unwilling to move out, And this is what's so sad, because it puts her in such a difficult situation. You know, now she's probably got responsibility of the child, and if she moves out, now she's got to pay bills, and how do you do all this stuff? But I would say again that she should move out. At some level, you know, and this is a part of the conversation, obviously, but there are many professing Christians who think it's totally appropriate to engage in sexual intimacy with somebody that they're not married to. And that is flat out, it doesn't even make sense. It's like a claiming to be a vegan and eating meat all the time. Like at some point, you're not who you really claim to be. And so there is that deep, and I'm not saying this is easy, but that deep-seated, deep-rooted level of conviction that says, before anything else, I'm going to submit to a higher authority than this boyfriend. I'm going to submit to God and put him first and make sure he's first in you know, this life. Hopefully they get married. That would be best for them. That'd be best for the child.
But at this point, why would he?
Right.
Because he has everything that he wants.
Right.
Without that level of commitment.
Because she's allowing that.
Because she's allowing that to happen. Mm-hmm. And there's something called functional fixedness, where men don't want to change unless there's a reason to, unless it changes something within mm-hmm. him, unless he feels the pinch of that, yeah. I guess. And I think this is a principle in a lot of areas for women. You know, why would Joel take out the trash if I'm going to do it for him all the time? Mm-hmm. So I think the same is true.
Men don't normally change if what they're doing seems to be working for them.
Right.
They're just going to stay the course. So you have to change the equation.
Yeah. And this is not a case of submission because they're not married.
Not married. Mm-hmm.
And so she has every right to move out. And I think that she should if he won't. Because she deserves that love and that commitment from a man. Mm-hmm. And God has that for her. That's his best for her. And I don't think that she should settle for anything less. And I understand it's difficult. She might need to go back to mom and dad and all of that. But it will be better for her in the long run, I believe.
Yeah. And it's there's consequences either way. But it's really worse. I mean, God's way is best. And so in this situation, you're raising a child in a home that says, oh, it's totally fine not to get married, to not have that level of covenant love relationship with somebody, to bear children, to date, to you know, give the guy whatever he wants or whatever, you know what I mean? I mean, you're modeling that for your child. Well, what are they going to do? What decisions are they going to make? Don't expect them to make any other decisions as they get older. Instead, have a story to tell that says, you know what, when you were 3 years old, oh, I gave my life to Jesus, and here's what needed to happen, and, you know, whatever. Maybe she even loves her father. Well, he doesn't love her, though. That's the problem. I mean, you say, well, they love each other. No, he doesn't love her unless he's willing to commit to her. There is no love without commitment.
And even if they are married, so to speak, to the question, you know, you're in a marriage relationship where the husband is not a believer. Again, we go back to that 1 Peter 3 passage mm-hmm. that our submissive spirit can help to change him and to grow him into Christ-likeness. That doesn't mean we enable in these situations.
Right, yeah.
We continue to operate in our respective roles with a quiet spirit and with respect. But we need to submit in that way. And
yeah, and that's why this is such a tough question, but I would just say this. That's why it's so critical that, you know, men and women, but in this case a woman, chooses very wisely who they're going to have a relationship with, you know, and to the point of having a child with. I mean, this is not a joke. It's not a simple fix. It's not easy. There's going to be a lot of pain and difficulty that comes with it. So, you know, it doesn't necessarily help in this instance to say that, but it's for those of you maybe that aren't married yet to say, choose wisely.
Yeah.
That's great. And it's great input and really encouraging because in today's society, if the thought is, if you do the right thing, you'll be happy. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times the right thing is the hard thing to do, especially as a Christian living in this world. Yeah. And so very encouraging.
Yeah.
The next question comes along that same kind of line, and that deals if you're in a dysfunctional relationship, living with somebody with an addiction. Mm. How do you handle that? The specific question dealt with alcoholism. I'm married to a non-Christian alcoholic. At the end of the day, I don't know how to be a good wife to the bottle at night and a man in the morning. Mm. How do you deal with someone who has a an addiction, is not willing to give it up, or is just in a dysfunctional relationship?
Mm. Well, first of all, I just want to extend my compassion. And this is so hard. And we've run across many marriages, as I know you have, Cliff, where this is the case, where there's some kind of addiction, whether it be anything from tobacco to, pornography to
gambling,
alcohol to gambling. We've dealt with all of those scenarios.
Eating, child pornography.
Yeah.
Then, yeah.
Yeah. And it's really, really hard for a woman.
Video games. I mean, it sounds silly, but it's all those things that control, a person's life.
And we so desperately as women want the best for our men. We want them to be happy. We want them to be healthy. We want them to be a good role model for our children, and we want things to change. But when an addiction is involved, it's just has such a grip on our husbands' lives that it's really, really hard. And my heart just goes out to these women who have struggled with this. And yet we have seen many women persevere and do the right thing, and the relationship has gotten healthy. And they're beautiful examples of what a Christ-like wife should be like.
So this is
really, really hard. But I think the roles still apply.
Yeah.
The role still, unless he is asking you to do something sinful,
right,
unless he's being abusive, which could be the case with alcoholism, but unless he's asking you to, you still have the role to play as a respectful and submissive wife. There's got to be something you can encourage him in. Yeah. There's got to be something that you can respect him for. You might have to dig really deep and look really hard, but the rules still apply. The roles still apply in this situation.
And stepping out of that enabling kind of role as well, because enabling is not love. What you want to do is love your husband. Okay, so continuing to buy him alcohol is not the loving thing to do. That might be the easiest thing to remove conflict or whatever in the relationship, but it's not the loving thing. Love, how do you define it, Joy? Love does what's
love
best.
Love is doing what is best for another person in the long run.
In the long run, right.
Yeah.
So what's best for him? It's that he stops drinking. I mean, it's not best to allow him to have a couple glasses of wine and jump in the car. Because he could get a DUI, he could hurt somebody else, he could, it might remove conflict. So what we're not saying is avoid conflict.
Mm-hmm.
There might be a time where you have to enter into conflict and maybe appeal to somebody he respects, a friend, a pastor, his dad, whoever.
You might have to set up an intervention. You might have to go to those kinds of lengths.
It can't continue. It can't. I mean, as much as you're able, it can't continue. Now, if it does continue, to Joy's point is heeded well. Unless he's calling you or your family to do something wrong or sinful, then it's to kind of make lemonade out of lemons. I mean, it's to make the best of a terrible situation.
And I love what Joel preached on this, maybe a year ago, that our circumstances plus our perspective equals our experience.
Our personal experience. So whatever you're experiencing today, if it's good or bad, it's circumstances plus your perspective. Well, can you change your circumstances?
Maybe not. You aren't going to be able to change your husband necessarily.
Right. But you can change
Your perspective. And how you look at that situation. So whatever you can do to get him help, but not to be his mother.
Yeah.
Right? To be his mother. And then just continue. And again, prayer. I know it sounds super spiritual, but it can change. God can change his heart.
You need a God moment there. I mean, you literally need a time when he just becomes broken and sees his folly. And that might be hitting kind of proverbial bottom of the whatever, you know, the end of his rope or hitting the bottom or whatever. So, but prayer to hang on for yourself and prayer for God to do something just miraculous in his life. Anything else to add?
Yeah, Cliff, that's such you a deal with one. This with you and your wife.
It's so complex, the issue, because it's not just the drinking. That's a way they're dealing with
another
pain.
Issue. Yeah,
and it's usually a childhood hurt
yeah.
that they're masking.
Yeah,
and alcohol, pornography, most addictions are just masking a pain.
Yeah,
so it's until you can find out, and maybe that's the encouraging thing to the spouse. See if you can find out what that pain is, so you can begin to address that rather than the Band-Aid that's on the pain. The alcoholism, as bad as that is,
yeah.
and just what you said, we need to do. Don't let them drive, all of that. Don't enable them.
Yeah.
But what are they masking? Mm. What's that real hurt there? Because once they you can tap into that,
yeah.
then you can begin to help them heal that hurt.
Yeah.
And practically speaking, how does a woman do that when maybe the man doesn't see the issue? You know, usually if they're involved in alcoholism, they don't see the problem. So how do you get to the hurt? Do you encourage them to go to a counselor? Do you just ask them questions? What would you suggest?
All of the above, obviously. But then it might even be if there's family members that are still living or around, parents, to actually, if they're not willing to go there, that you can help kind of behind the scenes get an idea of what that is and then to begin to address it. And look at your spouse as a really hurting person rather than, and again, it's that, I love that circumstances, perspective, experience, because if you can look at them from a different perspective, this person, I'm making this up, this person was abused physically as a child, and this is how they're dealing with it because they've never really dealt with it. You give them a little more grace than you would is it's all about them and all they care about is the bottle.
Yeah.
Well, they don't care about the bottle. They care about trying to mask that pain because the pain's just too strong to deal with.
Yeah.
It's just like, I don't know how to deal with it. And then it would be like, well, let me grab your hand and let's walk through this together.
Yeah.
And I'm going to be that helper now.
Yes.
That's my role that I'm going to help you with. And stuff.
That's good.
That's so good. You know, and I would just, the last little piece of encouragement to live kind of hopefully is to live as if one day he's going to be free from that addiction. So you don't know that, but live as if one day he will. Live as if you're going to be writing a book about this story. Now, you don't want a bunch of chapters in that book about, you know, you kind of living without hope and being difficult and whatever because he's got his issues. Instead, you'd want the story of your life to be, you know, I was faithful. I loved him enduringly. You know, I got him the help he needed. I protected him whenever I could, kind of thing. So if he does change some way someday, or God gets a hold of his heart, you've got an amazing story to tell and actually a beautiful picture that you've put on display of the gospel in your life. And if he doesn't change, you can say, you know what? I suffered well in this. I endured well in this difficult marriage. Mm-hmm. And even that's beautiful.
Good. Really good. Last question somewhat ties into this dysfunctional type of relationship. And that is, the question was, how is trust renewed after unfaithfulness? And maybe even assuming that the wife was unfaithfulness, much is said about the unfaithful man. But in a marriage, and let's assume it's two Christians, how do you renew that trust once one of the partners has broken it?
Well, again, a tough one here. But the two words that came to our minds as we were talking about this was honestly and slowly. So honestly, meaning the offender, the one who was involved in this affair, has to come completely clean. Whether it's, you know, I'm sure there's almost always pornography involved or emotional affair. How'd this happen? How long has it happened? I mean, come completely clean. And then because if you don't and something else pops up later, all you've done is torn that Band-Aid off again or reopened that wound, and now they can't trust you again. And then slowly is the other piece. In our culture, we want everything to happen quickly. You know, I want my husband to be free of alcohol tomorrow. You know, I want our marriage to be free from conflict in 3 weeks or whatever. Well, this is years of making good choices that's going to build a strong marriage. So in this case, it's with consistent, lots of little choices over the course of your marriage.
And I think if you're the one that has been offended, love is a choice. And if we look at the characteristics of love, that it's patient, you know, so, okay, they might mess up again. They might make a mistake. They might take three steps forward and make one step back. That's not to end the relationship completely. But if you've chosen to stay in this relationship, love is patient and it's kind. It believes all things. It hopes all things. It looks at things from a positive perspective instead of the suspicious mindset all the time. Now, you don't want to be naive. I'm not saying that. But there's again, that perspective that we need to approach so that our experiences are different. But it is. It's that long, making the same choices, good choices, little choices in the same direction over a long period of time.
Because love is a choice. Love's not only a choice. Some people say love is only a choice. It's not only a choice. There's emotion. There's other things involved in love. But love is also, you know, a choice. And so that's great. I mean, what does love look like? It's living lovingly, you know. That's kind of the goal there. So it's giving grace. It's not, if you've forgiven them, then you can't keep bringing up this, like you can't keep holding that sin against them because you really haven't forgiven them because God, you know, doesn't hold our sin against us, right? Because he's fully forgiven us. So, and it's not that you'll ever forget what happened, but even in that damage, even in that wounding, choosing not to hold that against them, taking lots of choices over time, I mean, that trust could be grown stronger than ever. Even though you remember that offense or those offenses in the past, again, over time, over years, it could be just an amazing picture of grace in your marriage and really experiencing and feeling that. So,
and I would say one thing, and Cliff, maybe from the counseling perspective, you can add something here, but you want to hope for progress and have that positive, but be prepared maybe for a misstep. I don't know that they're all completely done with and healed and all that with no mistakes. I think some people think, okay, we're just, it's never going to happen again. And it's never, and we hope for that. But if for some reason they forget to tell you where they're going, or you happen to see a wayward email,
or they do take a step back, like you were saying earlier.
Right.
It's seeing the whole of what's happening, you know, and not, that's a firm footing, right? I mean, you can slip a little bit here or there, and if there's a strong relationship in a covenantal relationship, the marriage can still survive. But if you're walking on eggshells and you're kind of looking for that next step that he or she sins or falls or whatever, then it's just not going to work. And so living in that stream of grace and forgiveness, as God has given us grace and forgiveness, I don't know how else you do it. You know, so.
Thoughts?
Yeah, no, you're really right. I mean, the offended person usually immediately builds a wall around them to protect so they don't get hurt again. I'm going to protect myself. And in reality, they're the only ones that can take that wall down. The offender is, I like Joel's illustration. They're wanting it right away. I'm sorry, I messed up. It'll never happen again. We should go right back to normal.
Right.
That wall's not going to come down. It's only as the offender begins to build trust again does that wall come down at the offendee's pace.
Yeah. Right.
But they got to have the attitude that Joy talked about, that love is kind and patient and all of that, and wanting to take that down. And then they can start as they see the offenders start to build the trust up, then that wall slowly goes down. But it's a time process.
Yeah, but that's the hope too.
Such a deep pain, yeah. Oh, exactly.
Right? I mean, it's not to say this is going to take a long time. The hope is that actually it will get stronger and it will get healthy. And so there's hope in that, even in the worst case scenario. And, you know, it's never happened to Joy and I, you know, thank the Lord. But, you know, it's just that would be devastating. But you don't need to live in that devastation forever.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And you're creating a story that you can pass on to say, look how God restored us.
Absolutely.
And then you can help somebody else who's gone through that.
Absolutely.
And really, 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 really. I mean, it's in those moments where you figure out, hey, is this relationship based on covenantal love? You know, the I'll love you regardless of what you do to me kind of love, or mm-hmm. or something else.
Right.
Read the book of Hosea, you know, where God calls the prophet Hosea to actually marry a prostitute.
Yeah.
You know, to demonstrate God's relationship with Israel, who kept, you know, committing quote unquote adultery against him. So, and it's, you know, I would just add this, that's if you choose to stay in the marriage, you know, and I would rarely recommend divorce. And I think most people know my stance on that, very rarely. But there is that allowance in Scripture that if he or she chooses to not unite themselves with somebody else, then you have that freedom. But there's, of course, consequences to that, too. It's not a, never a clean slate and an easy break. I would instead encourage people to say, okay, what could be the story of your life in spite of being hurt so terribly, in spite of offending some, your spouse, the one you're, you know, called to love till you die so severely? You know, through time, through honesty, this relationship was made strong and healthy again. Now that's a story to tell, that puts the gospel on display, that gives people hope, and you know, that gives even a lot of meaning to your life and the way that God can use you.
Yeah, and I would just end with this. I probably most people have heard of Ted Haggard and this prominent evangelical pastor who fell into some deep sin, and his wife, Gail, I heard her speak one time, and somebody said, how is it that you were able to stay in this marriage through, you know, just this media attention and all the things that came out and all his lying to you? And she said, I just sat down with the Lord, and he asked me, Gail, who do you want to be in this story? Who do you want to be? We know who Ted is in this story, but who do you want to be in this story? And that gave her the courage to rise up into a Christ-like role within the relationship. And so to all the women out there.
And that's what makes it so beautiful.
It's what makes it beautiful. Yeah. And to all the women out there, who do you want to be in this story? When your children look at you, when one day you see God face to face, what kind of story do you want to create? And who do you want to be within that?
And in this case, since the wife is the offender, I would ask the men the same question. You know, you've been hurt severely. Your wife has been unfaithful to you. I mean, it's a reality. We don't need to pretend that it didn't happen. In light of that truth, in light of that reality, who is God calling you to be? How are you going to respond? Nobody's saying it's easy, but the best stories never are, you know, a bunch of easy choices. So,
well, thank you very much. The topic of a godly marriage and the roles and responsibilities is always brings about a lot of hard questions, and you guys have dealt with them very well. I just take away hope from this. You guys are so encouraging, and in each situation, there's hope, no matter what your circumstance. So thank you for submitting questions. Thank you, Joy and Joel, for answering them.
Thank you, and, Cliff. And thank you for thanking us.
Well, thank you for thanking me.
I love our church, and I just it's exciting to see, you know, and hear about the stories of marriages that are being reconciled and families being repaired. And I'm just so proud of each of, you know, anybody listening that's choosing God's way over the world's way. You'll never regret it.
Thank you.
Thanks.